Ryan Stanton here with ASEP Frontline, joined today by Dr. Neil Flomenbaum. He is the editor-in-chief of Emergency Medicine and very active person. And what I wanted to bring in today is a discussion of moving emergency medicine outside the walls of the department. Some great articles that he has written, some editorials on community paramedicine, but also some things that are coming up that we'll be talking about more of how we are as emergency medicine trying to tear down those walls and move outside our departments to provide the best care for our patients. And that's right up my alley, because as an EMS medical director, I am one that believes that the best care is continuous care and not trying to silo every aspect of care, which can cause breaks and loss of information and challenges. So Dr. Flomenbaum, thank you for joining me. Let's start off by mentioning to everybody where you are and how this became a passion for you.
Well, I sometimes think of the publication Emergency Medicine and the other publications I've been associated with over the last 43 years, like Goldfrank's Toxicologic Emergencies, as my night job as opposed to my day job, although probably the hours are reversed if you're practicing emergency medicine. I've been a practicing emergency medicine physician for all of that time, most recently physician in chief of emergency medicine, New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell, now emeritus in that title, served in that capacity from 1996 to 2016, and I'm now actively the physician in chief of our emergency medical services, which includes 43 ambulances and about 497 EMTs and paramedics operating with BLS, ALS, and critical care, hazmat, decon. We do long distance transfers and provide a lot of critical care inter-hospital. So it keeps me busy, and it also keeps me thinking, and it helps because the subject of the editorials, such as the ones you just mentioned, are directly related to the experiences I have in emergency departments, in emergency medicine. And that's what led me over the years to think that emergency physicians, in a sense, in a real sense, are better than emergency departments. They don't just exist in an emergency department. They do, and they can, and that's probably still the main part of what they do. But all the talent, all the skills can be applied in a variety of settings. And I think in the future, it's going to become much, much more important as the emphasis continues to shift from hospital-based everything, inpatient services, and even emergency departments, to providing that care in an outpatient setting. We've all experienced the rapid rise of urgent care centers, freestanding emergency departments, telemedicine, community-based paramedicine. It's a whole new world out there. One of the things I'm very proud of is a few years ago when the National Hockey League decided that they wanted and needed emergency physicians at every home game. In addition to the team physicians, we were able to negotiate a contract. We're New York based, so it's New York Rangers, of course. Which I hope has a good season again, and getting a little bit nervous. But it's been great to be there and be an emergency physician and not only take care of patients who need it outside the emergency department, but to be able to appropriately utilize emergency medical services and coordinate all of the care from where it occurs to where the patient needs to be.
Emergency medicine is definitely growing out there, and you mentioned event medicine with the New York Rangers, and you know I've done work with NASCAR in the past, and there's definitely a preference for emergency physicians because not only expertise with the traumatic side of things, but also with everything else. I mean, that's we found that working some of these events that you're dealing with, the common stuff, colds, infections, sunburn, and then of course chest pain and stroke-related symptoms on top of all the potential trauma. And so it does make that make it a very attractive specialty for these types of places that have very diverse populations. The main focus that you have with working with EMS, and I've experienced it as well, as we are pushing outside the front doors. It was just a few decades ago, it wasn't very long, that EMS was basically an ambulance of the funeral home that may be there just to pick up. And if you're alive, you go to the hospital. They transport you to the hospital. No real care, just basically a ride. If you're dead, then they take you there too, to their place. And and now it's evolved. Whether it's the EMT type, the basic BLS type efforts, the ALS type efforts, and now we're getting more and more advanced. I mean, even some communities with the stroke wagons that go out and provide, do CT scans and do TPA, and which is a little bit. There's a lot of discussions on how that's going to play in. But that being said, the moral from my standpoint is that this care, we are doing our best to push care closer and closer to the patient, knowing that many of the things we deal with, the unstable serious conditions, are time sensitive. So, my question is, how, with that moving out front, what is that drive to move the emergency services, emergency care, closer to the patient in need, and how is that going to benefit them?
Well, you've just touched on the single most important topic, and it encompasses what I said before, but let me just take one particular example that you just mentioned. We have a stroke mobile. We've deployed it now for about a year. You might question why we would need a stroke mobile in Manhattan with all the hospitals we have and the designated stroke centers and the efficiencies we've developed in the emergency department from the time the patient arrives, even before that, coordinating with our EMS personnel, getting all the blood work done, getting the CT scan done, other diagnostic tests as necessary, and getting the TPA into patients for whom they're in, it's indicated. But we wanted to see if it worked in Manhattan so that we could then move it to the outer boroughs and perhaps even the suburbs. And of course, in rural areas, that's the only possible way to get TPA into a patient within a window. You could question whether TPA is the best drug or definitive drug. It's the only drug right now. Hopefully there'll be better drugs in the future, and there are other things that would make you wonder about the whole process, perhaps, and hope that it improves. But I would point out one thing to you and to our listeners, and that is that the stroke mobile, if you think about it, equipped with a CT scanner, the ability to transfer the radiographs to someone reading it and interpreting it, and a qualified person to administer TPA if it's indicated. All of that technology that's in the back of an ambulance, when you think of an elderly person who tends to fall at home, doesn't particularly want to come to the hospital, gets stuck sometimes in overcrowded emergency departments on stretchers and hallways because you're trying to rule out head trauma that perhaps is a subdural subarachnoid, when perhaps you can take that person to the back of the ambulance, do the scan there, and if luckily it's not a subdural or subarachnoid, avoid transporting the patient to the hospital, leave the patient back home where they want to be, where they belong, or in a nursing home before they lose a bed. I think that's where it's all headed, and I hope to see some of the stroke mobiles that we deploy used for that purpose as well. So it may be, in a certain sense, reversing the clock and going back to home care and treating patients at home, but the difference is we're doing it with the supervision, at the very least, and direct participation in many cases of emergency physicians. And again, they can do things there, not just in the emergency department, that few other physicians can do. And the events that you mentioned, for the most part, it might be treating colds and people who get into trouble and people who drink too much wine and things like that, until, God forbid, something happens, and then they can treat that too. As long as, hopefully, they're not victims as well. And I don't think I need to be any more specific about what I'm referring to, but that's the reality that we live with. So event care is going to be extremely important unless we stop having events, and I hope we never do. One of the things that we do in New York, out of New York Presbyterian Hospital, and we've done it for many years, like so many other hospitals around the country, is to provide the medical care for the Avon Walk for Breast Cancer Research, a two-day event. Two-day walk with an overnight village, and it's been a very satisfying way of providing care, not in the emergency department, but providing first-quality emergency care.
The two things this is about, it's about access and options. Now, you mentioned the stroke mobile that you guys have, and, I talked a little bit earlier today for another podcast about a physician who practices in Alaska with their limitations and challenges. And I think what we're learning is that our cookbook doesn't have just one recipe in it. We need to have a bunch of recipes based on the needs and demands of our communities, our environment, our population, our strengths, our weaknesses. You know, what are we going to see? Of course, you guys in New York will have a significant focus on, you know, terrorist type things, mass casualty type events, whereas in our area, of course, we practice for chemical weapons because we have a stockpile nearby. We also have a fair risk of tornadoes, and so we'll practice for that. So understanding, that being said, what I'm meaning is understanding your needs, and the more options we have to tailor the care for our specific needs will provide better care for those patients. And also is access. You mentioned the opening of walk-in clinics, urgent treatments, freestanding emergency departments. You know, not every community, not every city can support a large tertiary care hospital. And we have to gear the care towards our patient needs, but also then do everything we can to improve the access to care that we're seeing that we can provide. And that's what we're providing in emergency medicine now, are those options that aren't necessarily that large multi-specialty tertiary care center, but really what is needed in our area in order to help get the access, but also with efficiency and cost in mind.
Yes, and we are living, fortunately, in a time when we could combine all of those and tailor make the solutions to the needs. So you don't need a multi-specialty practice to be able to provide first-rate initial emergency care, diagnosis and treatment sometimes, but if you're wondering what the next step would be and you're still in that remote area, through telemetry, telehealth, telemedicine, you can get a consult involved, and it particularly helps if there's an emergency physician. You don't just transfer the patient and say, see you, but stay involved, because what the consult has to say, the specialist in a remote area, the emergency physician can implement too. And when it's necessary, we can transport the patient. When it isn't, we can treat the patient there and follow the patient and, you know, arrange for appropriate follow-up. So all of those things are possibilities now that never existed before. And it's another way of bringing medicine to the patient instead of bringing the patient to the emergency department. As a population ages, and it will continue to age for the next 30, 40, 50 years, as my generation, a baby boomer generation, makes its way through old age, living longer, living better, but with a lot of comorbidities and problems, it's going to be particularly important to be able to bring that care to the patient instead of transporting those patients to the emergency department. And I would tell you, you know, sometimes it's difficult convincing young people, including young physicians, including young emergency physicians, that this is an important area of medicine. And it's like, oh, another older person. Oh, okay. But you know what? I have yet to find anything that we do for an older person that hurts a younger person. In other words, if we spend the extra time, deal with differential diagnoses that are not as obvious in older people, if their pain response is blunted, and we get good at that, it's not going to hurt the way we deliver care to younger persons. It may not be necessary, but it's not going to hurt them either. So I think it's a challenging form of medicine, challenging form of emergency medicine. It's the future, but I can't think of a group of physicians who are better qualified to do all of that than emergency physicians. And I am so very grateful that I had the opportunity to get involved 43 years ago at the beginning and stay with it till now. I wouldn't want to do it any other way. I wouldn't want to spend my time in any other form of medicine. Not that they're not all valuable, but my God, what a great journey it's been.
Oh, wow, how it's changed as more and more is pushed and sent our way, not only because of the needs of the society and the folks we treat, but also because we're a trusted source. We're folks that are willing to learn that specialty. We're learning that stuff in order to advance those practices and to provide more care.
Our listeners can't see me smiling right now from what you said, and just listening to the way you presented it. When we started emergency medicine as a specialty, we said, give us everything you got that you can't take care of. You know, we're here. We love it. We want to take care of patients. And you know what? Boy, did they ever take us up on that. And the problems kept coming. And patients who needed to go to isolation rooms and go upstairs, we had to figure out how to treat them in the emergency department. And everything and anything that was a problem, we ended up with. And to that extent, what we did in the beginning continues to this day. And we may have much more sophisticated technology. We may have wonderful non-invasive ways of finding out information that we didn't have before. But the reason I'm smiling is, and it's the title of one of the editorials I wrote years ago, the expression in English, the more things change, the more they stay the same. The excitement that we all felt 43 years ago, it's still there, and it's what keeps us young. And emergency medicine, more than any other specialty, allows emergency physicians to reinvent themselves. You're interested in toxicology after getting interested in emergency medicine? It's a natural. Pre-hospital care, it's a natural. I started the first geriatric emergency medicine fellowship in our hospital in 2005, and now it's becoming more apparent that that's necessary. Perhaps in the future, women's health emergencies, critical care emergency medicine. There's so many ways to slice the pie, and they're not traditional subspecialties, but they're needed now, and maybe they won't be needed 100 years from now. But you know what? That's what it is now, and emergency physicians are really good, really innovative at figuring out what's needed and rising to the occasion.
The nice thing is, whatever comes in and goes out, we're a one-generation physician. So my practice is going to be geared towards the current generations and things we see. There may be some adjustments, but, you know, as I age out, the new generations coming along will acquiesce to the needs of those generations. So, you know, the next 20, 30 years is going to be very much a geriatric-driven environment because of the baby boomer population, which you'd mentioned. And I work in a department that having multiple patients at any given moment over age 85, if not multiple on my list at the time over age 90, is not unusual at all. Now, going back, you mentioned one thing that that is really coming into its own right now. You know, I've heard about it for a number of years, but it's finally starting to get some legs as technology starts to catch up, cellular networks, data. Opportunities, and that is telehealth, being able to reach out. And I firmly believe that, you know, one of the access challenges we face can be addressed in many ways with having access via telemedicine to board certified or specialty trained emergency physicians, being able to have access to these smaller communities where you can't support an emergency department, where you have a fully staffed board certified emergency medicine presence, but are going to have legitimate, you know, emergency stuff that could benefit from having that. So being able to have, you know, whether it's, whatever the provider basis is, but being able to reach out and have those communications, or, you know, one thing we've talked about is the transport with EMS, especially pediatric critical care, being able to, or stroke care, being able to be involved there to start to guide the treatments and during transport. So that care is already in process and taking advantage of that time that they're with healthcare providers, but not necessarily in the emergency department, in order to be able to get the wheels rolling, advance the care, and just have that much more stuff done before they get to the emergency department.
I'm glad you mentioned that too, because obviously telehealth, telemedicine, that's the latest interest, latest fad maybe, but you know what? It's not new. It's been around for a long time. When the paramedic training programs began in the 1970s, 1974, and after that, we had to come up with a way to be able to get our paramedics to treat patients in the field for a variety of critical care emergencies, different than trauma surgery and different than scoop and run. The emphasis then and now, of course, was let's do everything we can do in the emergency department right there. Let's defibrillate the patient. Let's do what we need to do. So every system I know has come up with standing protocols. We go out of our way to train paramedics to recognize patterns, arrhythmias, illnesses. And then, if it doesn't solve the problem, there's telemetry. Well, telemetry and medical options, that was the first form of telehealth. Difference being that in that area, the patient ended up one way or the other, hopefully alive, and someone who we could then continue to treat and make well. They end up in the emergency department, and we saw them afterwards. With telehealth, if it's something that isn't critical and it's something that can be treated definitively at home, then you never do get to see the patient unless you arrange for some follow-up system. So it's a little bit different, but, you know, like I said before, everything old is new again. That's really the emphasis. But what's driving it now, if everyone's wondering, well, how come, you know, you've been doing this telemetry with paramedics since the 1970s, so why all of a sudden telehealth, telemedicine? like several other areas in medicine, emergency medicine, what's driving this now, I believe, is the Affordable Care Act and making healthcare accessible to so many more people. But there weren't any additional providers in that bill so far that would increase the supply of physicians and nurse practitioners, physician assistants. So telehealth is another way of getting the care to people, even if they don't come to the emergency department, and hopefully obviating the need for them to sit in the waiting room or to spend hours in the ED when it's something that can be treated that way. So again, a very, very promising area of medicine.
And I do believe it's wonderful ideas that technology is finally catching up to make it. I mean, it's almost like the ultrasound of the last number of years. You know, when I trained on ultrasound, the ultrasound was a hand-me-down from our friends up in OBGYN. And so it read out like a, you know, an old 50s black and white TV with very difficult image, difficult to see, and so you had significant limitations. But now just looking around the exhibition hall here, I mean, I've got a fantastic machine at my shop, but just looking around here with portable, cost-effective that you can personally own. I mean, I saw one down here for $2,000 that links up to your cellular phone and, you know, provides incredible images, so a great portable option. I mean, there's several here, I don't want to single out a particular product itself, but, you know, the wonderful ideas and motivation, which is kind of the hallmark of emergency medicine, that is now coupled with technology that is catching up to that demand and giving us those opportunities to really advance those ideas. And I see that a lot with telehealth and telemedicine, is the abilities to get great images, to have high speed connections, to be able to get out to places that you couldn't get before. And so, what I see is the opportunities moving forward to really expand what we can do in emergency medicine, even to the bedside of the patient at their home.
So what you're saying is it's just a matter of time before, instead of just doing sonograms, ultrasounds, we can do ultrasound selfies on our iPhones.
Yeah, absolutely, and we'll post those on the Twitterage. You know, this is my selfie from my portable ultrasound machine. Or you can sit back at your home in New York and watch me do an ultrasound in Kentucky and tell me what I'm doing right or wrong or otherwise. So Dr. Neil Flomenbaum, MD, Editor-in-Chief for Emergency Medicine, people want more information from you. How can they get in touch with you via the email, social media, and via your productions here?
Well, there's my email address, nef2002@med.cornell.edu, or you can look me up. You can Google my name and probably find a way to contact me, and I would be glad to talk to anybody who's interested in discussing any of this further.
All right, and as for us, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, or @everydaymed on Twitter. Make sure that you're subscribing to our podcast either via SoundCloud or iTunes, and join us as we bring you more information every week. And for ASAP Frontline, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton. We'll see you next time.